All right, so we are still in Parakhet chapter 8. We will not finish chapter 8 this week. There is an awful lot going in this story. After we had Parakvav, which was where we set the stage and talked about oppression by Midian and Hashem's rebuke via the Navi for the people, Gideon encountered this either Navi or Malach, some sort of being, and he had the miracle happen with the consumption of the food that he had offered, and then he had his first mission to destroy the Mizbeach, and then he had his second miracle in which the dew fell on the ground, but the first it was that the wool was wet and the ground around it was dry, and then the reversal of it, and then that brought us into the seventh parak, the seventh chapter, and Gideon's second mission, that of culling the army that he had summoned to fight against Midian. And then he had his third miracle, which was overhearing the dream in the camp of Midian, in which he discovers that they're all afraid of him. And then he went to war against Midian. And in first, they rout the Midianite camp, but the Midianites flee to the east, and Gideon and crew go after them. And that was where we hit the first problem, the first snag in things, and that was in the very beginning of Parakhet, the beginning of chapter 8, when we had the ingratitude of Ephraim, where they complain, why are you only summoning us now? His response is to placate them and to say, what do you mean? The best of us isn't like the worst of you, which was either a comparison in terms of their deeds, because all we did was rout them initially, but you're conquering their leaders, or it was a statement about the quality of Ephraim versus his own group, and saying, you guys are much better than we are. But as Ralbag noted, what Gideon is really trying to do is just put this problem away so that he can go about the business of winning the war. He doesn't want it to be a distraction. Then, last time, we had our second decline, and that's one that we're still working our way through, and that's the business of Sukkot and Penuel. And Gideon is pursuing those who have fled east of the Yarden, and he arrives at two cities in succession, by the Yarden, one of which is Sukkot, and the other one is Penuel. And as we saw last week, the first in the city of Sukkot, they refused to help him. He said, my people are tired, and we're pursuing the war against the enemy, so would you please give us some food? And they say, it's not as though you've beaten the enemy yet. You haven't beaten Zebach and Salmunna yet, so that we should give this to you, and they refuse to give. And then he goes to the people and he threatens them and says, fine, after I beat them, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to beat you up with thorns. And we discussed why thorns in particular. Then he went to the people of Penuel and asked them for support, and they also refused, and he says, I'm going to destroy your fortress, because they have this great fortress, and they trust their fortress for protection from him. So he says, I'm going to destroy, or for protection from Midian, he says, I'm going to destroy your fortress. We give other explanations for why he's going to do worse to Penuel, but I'll leave that right now. It's with the recording last week anyway. He goes after Zebach and Salmunna, who have this massive camp, thousands and thousands of people, and yet he manages to rout them, either because he fights them at night, and does the same thing that he did earlier against Midian, where he surrounds the camp and does the whole intimidation tactic and gets them on the run that way. Or alternatively, because they assume that he has more people by now. Like, they figure it's not 300 men anymore, he must have others, which he actually does when you think about it, all the people he brought down from Har Ephraim. So he has others on his side, but either way, he ends up defeating Zebach and Salmunna. He captures Zebach and Salmunna, the two leaders themselves, and then he goes back to Sukkot and Penuel, and that's what we're up to. So Parakhet, chapter 8, sentence 13 was the last bit that we had done, in which we are told he returned Milema'alei Hechores, which was a very strange term, did not seem to be the name of a place that we could figure, and so we gave a few different explanations, all of which assume that the word chares here, chares, is a reference to the sun. So either it's he came back from the east, the place where the sun comes up, Male, the place where the sun comes up, or it was that he came back before sunset, while the sun was still up, or alternatively, Radak, Malbim, Abarbanel say, no, he fought the enemy at night, and he came back because the sun was coming up. Meaning once the sun comes up and Midian can see that he only has 300 men, you know, it's all over. So when the sun comes up, he says, okay, time for me to head west. Been fun. And that brings us to Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14, which we started on last time, and we already saw requires some explanation because some strange things happened here. Vayilkod Narman Shesukos. He captures a kid, a youth of some kind. Nar in Tanakh is amorphous. Sometimes Tanakh means a young kid, and sometimes it refers to someone who's a servant. It's not clear what form Nar means here, but he captures a Nar at any rate. And Vayishalayahu, he inquires of him, Vayichtov Veilav, and the kid writes down for him, Sarei Sukkos and Zikeneha, the names of the officers and elders of the city of Sukkot, Shivim v'shiva ish, 77 men. Now, if you go back to the initial story with Sukkot, it's back in Pasuk Vav, well, Pasukim Hey and Vav. We noted last week that Gideon addressed one group and was responded to by a different group. Right? Who did Gideon address back in Pasuk Hey? Anshei Sukkot, the population of Sukkot. And the response was Sarei Sukkot, the leaders of Sukkot. So Gideon now comes back and says, hey, find me Sarei Sukkot. And he gets this list of 77 people who are the bureaucracy of Sukkot. But then, look what he does. Vayavo el Anshei Sukkot. He comes to the people of Sukkot. Vayomer, and he said, Hine Zevach v'tzalmuna. You were looking for them, right? Here are Zevach and Tzalmuna, Asher Keraftem Osi, that you were very sharp in your response to me, even blasphemy is a term that we associate with Keruf. You were very harsh with me, Lemor, saying, Hachav Zevach and Tzalmuna, Tabi Adacha, do you have the hand of Zevach and Tzalmuna in your hand? Have you defeated them? Kini Tein Lan Ashecha Hayefim Lachem, such that we should give your tired men bread. So, do you remember me? Here are Zevach and Tzalmuna, and now you're in trouble.
Are they on display, these people? Like, what?
Yes.
Just like pulling them along? Or
presumably they're chained. I would guess. Yeah, I mean, they're not there willingly. Mm-hmm. This isn't like, hey, let's go on the road with
you,
though.
Kill them.
Not yet.
Why wouldn't you kill them?
Because you might prove the
assumption. I mean, you can break their head and hang it on the gallows. You know, and
right.
So, in the past,
right, no, it's an interesting point that he doesn't kill them first.
Bring the head.
Yeah, oh no, we've seen that before, and will yet again.
Yeah.
Why
keep them alive?
Right, why keep them alive? Maybe it could be for effect. In other words, there's an element of effect by displaying to the Jews, look, I've humbled the enemy. There's that element of it, and it also demonstrates that he is the one who did it. It isn't just like somebody else did it and I found it, took advantage, or whatever, like, here I am. So that may be part of it. Maybe also, I mean, these people were hungry and tired. They've been fighting this straight since the beginning. It could be he doesn't have the time to take care of it. Disposing of a king is not the same as just, you know, beating a common soldier. There's like, you know, there's ceremony, like, there's paperwork. There's a lot of that you have to contend with. So it's a good question, but it certainly makes for good theater.
Mm-hmm. So, Zevach and Tzalmuna were among the first ones that they, when they dispersed and ran away, they were part of that group, right?
They're from the group that ran away, yeah. Yeah. So, Vayikach, he got the list of leaders. Right? He got the list of leaders. He spoke to the regular population. But then look at Pasuk Tetzayin. Vayikach es ziknei ha'ir. He took the elders of the city. V'es kotzei ha'midbar, as well as the wild thorns. V'es ha'bar kanim, nettles. Vayoda bahem es anshei sukkos. And he does something called vayoda. We have to explain what that word means. To the anshei sukkot. So who was it? Who did he actually hurt?
The people.
The
people.
I think it's
a problem.
He did it to the elders, because they're the ones who said.
Yeah, but look at the pasuk.
That they saw it, the people saw it. Was that what it imprinted?
This is the problem. Leva, you were saying?
Like, he gathered them, maybe as witnesses, like, to watch.
Right,
he's...
It says,
like,
with them,
he
maybe they helped thrash.
Well, the question is what the Bahem is. Bahem with them could mean the thorns, and that's the logical antecedent.
Them.
He took the thorns and beat the people with them. This is very hard to figure out. It's not simple and straightforward. Not to mention this word vayoda is a really weird word. What do you have for your translations of vayoda?
And with them he
thrashed.
He broke.
Okay. Any other translations here? No, it's basically
tortured. That's what one of the.
That's interesting. The word vayoda is not a simple word. So we're going to go through a few different approaches here. One approach is radak. If you take a look on your sheet at source number one, radak offers a couple of ideas, but the one that I'm picking here is v'yitachen lefarsho kemashma'o. Could be explained the way it sounds. Shehodia lahem pisham im hakotzim. He informed them of their sins. Vayoda like ladat. He informed them of their sins with the thorns. It means that he let them know what they had done wrong. By now, by the time they get beaten with their thorns, they understand that they blew it in the way that they responded to him initially. He used the thorns to educate them. Yes. But but actually it's deeper than that. The excerpt that I brought you wasn't long enough. What Radak actually is suggesting here is that he punishes the leaders. In other words, when it said he took the Zekanim, those are the ones he hits with it. And by hitting them, he informs the general population of their sin. Because the general population, remember, was part of this in the first place. Right? Again, in the initial address that he made, he spoke to the people of the city. The elders were the ones who gave him this rude response. So he punishes the elders, but in so doing, he informs everybody of how what they did was terrible.
But there's no action towards elders aside from that he caught.
Well, according to what Radak is saying, they're the ones who he beats. But, and by hitting them, he informs Anshei Sukkot of what they've done wrong.
But it doesn't say that Ziknei Sukkot were the ones to turn him down his offer. It said Sarei Sukkot.
Right. The assumption is, in the way that Radak is reading it, that if you go back to the description of the people the youth listed for him, right, in which pasuk was it? Suddenly I'm not seeing it. Yadalid, thank you. He writes for him this Sari man, the Zakanim. It's sort of this group, right? It's not like you have a bicameral legislature where you have a house and a senate or something. It's the group of the elders and leaders. That's what we're talking about. So Radak says he beats up the elders and in so doing educates the population that what they did was wrong. And we already know why what they did was wrong. That was already discussed last week, right? Aside from the fact that they refused to help. Which you could understand in the sense that, as they said, tomorrow Zevach and Salmunah are going to come back and punish us for having given you support. But it's more than that. It's the image of not helping the rest of the Jews. Meaning, you're doing now exactly what Ammon and Moab did when we came out, and Midian as well, and Edom, when we came out of the Midbar. Right, we wanted to go into the land, and they blocked us, and they said, "No, we're not going to let you through our land." And they didn't offer us food. The Jews have become like these other nations. Among themselves, exactly.
Among their own people, it's not foreigners anymore.
Right, correct.
Their own people.
Right, and it's the hallmark of Midian. Again, every time we see Midian, you see this split in the population, people being separated from the community. In this case, we see that the people of Sukkot and Penuel, like Ephraim before them, in their own way, Ephraim is more an ingratitude issue, but they also hold themselves apart. So that's one way to take it. Abarbanel has a different approach. Surprise. Abarbanel says you should link Vayoda to something which, frankly, I'm kind of surprised to see him do. Vayeda Elokim. Where in the Chumash do we have the phrase Vayeda Elokim?
Creation?
Much later. Not much later, but later. Vayeda Elokim is when the Jews cry out to Hashem in Egypt. Hashem sees what's going on, and that's when he decides he's going to save them. So Barbanel says that Vayeda can be an expression of mercy. And so the way that he reads it, if you take a look at number 2 on your sheet, Va'asa zeh lezikney ha'ir. He did it to the elders, bilvad. He only harmed the elders, like what Radak said. Lefishahem heshivuhu hara'ahahi, because they were the ones who gave him that wicked reply of, we're not going to help you. Right, this is as we've already noticed. Gideon asked for bread from Sukkot in general. But the response didn't come from the nation, but from the officers, from these leaders. So that's why he punished the leaders. So that's what it means when it says that vayoda in the English, I didn't even translate it because I don't know how you would render it as and he was merciful. It's not really translatable the way he does it. But that's the meaning of vayoda with the thorns, anshei sukkot, meaning kamo vayeda elokim, lashon rachamim. It's an expression of mercy.
Not to the
zikah. Not to the but to the population. Right. He spared the population. That's the way that, that's the way Abarbanel reads it. Malbim is not going to be satisfied with this.
So he was merciful to the men of Sukkot.
To the general population.
Tortured them, but right. He was okay, right. So instead of broke the men of Sukkot, you're saying he was merciful to the
correct.
It's a very, okay.
Very different read. Now, Malbim isn't going to like this for a few reasons. One reason Malbim won't like this is because you're taking the word vayoda far away from what his clear meaning is in the sentence, which is, whether you say torture, hit, whatever it is, it's some form of physical violence to the population. That seems clear only from the context that that's what's going on. That's one objection that Malbim is going to have. But the other objection is that there's more that's weird about the rejection of the food in the first place. If you go back again to where he asked the people of Sukkot, and we noticed this last week, for whom did he ask food? Not from whom, but for whom?
For his soldier.
La'ama shevaraglai, right? The people who are with me, ki ayefim heim, because they are tired, right? They're exhausted. We've been running this whole time. To whom did they refuse the help? Litzvacha, your army. The wording changed. Why should the wording change? So last time we said that there are two reasons for him to demand help. One, we are your army, and therefore you should be helping to support us. Right? We're defeating Midian, who've been oppressing us for 7 years. The other is, we're Jews who are hungry and tired, and therefore you should help us. You know, the same way that when we were on our way into Israel, we should have been helped by those nations. You should certainly be helping us. Says Malbim, the rejection that they give is specifically because your army doesn't deserve it. Because you haven't won anything yet. What do you mean, your army? Right now, we're just, subjects of Midian. So take a look at what Malbim does in source number 3. He says, Ra'ah, ki sarei Sukkot einam ru'uyim la'onesh. He said, you know what? The leaders don't deserve to be punished. They didn't do anything wrong with their response. Ki ta'anu kidin. They argued correctly. Sha'adayim lo hayu mechuyavim la'seis lamas. That they have no obligation to pay tribute yet to him. You haven't won anything. You're not the authority. We don't owe your army anything. I mean, it sounds a little cold, but that's the argument. V'gam kill you yureim la'sozos. And by the way, they're also afraid because, you know, there's this other army that's a lot bigger than yours, right? And they're going to come and level us for helping you. So when the officers refuse to help the military, that part of it, he understands. He's not going to thrash them for that. Aval anshei sukkos, but the people of the city, shemehem sha'al b'taras tzedakah, mitzad sha'anashav ye'efim. He asked for help from them because his people were exhausted. Heim ru'uyim la'onesh. They deserve punishment. Vayodam bahem rotzalomar al yadam, shetzivash az kenim yasru az anshei sukkos. Here he's trying to resolve the last problem, which is why does the pasuk then say he took the elders and he beat the people? And the answer is that he actually took the elders, he gave them the thorns, and had them punish the population.
I don't like this.
Yeah, I don't like it.
You know what I like about it? I like about it the fact that it fits the psukim. That's the thing about Malvo.
It's okay, but the Sarim were the ones who turned it down, so why would they be willing to beat up their own people?
Because they turned it down on a military level. In other words, he turned to the communal authorities and said, I want your help because this is your army. He turned to the population and said, I want your help because these people are tired and hungry. The response from the bureaucrats was, well, we're not giving you, you're not our army, and it's not safe to give them in that sense. And he said, I don't like the answer, but I get it. But the population, I asked them just on a human level, and they were not forthcoming. And therefore, they deserve to be punished, and he takes the elders and has them punish the population. I understand that we don't like it. I get it. But I like the fact that he's actually accounting for the different problems in the psukim. This is what Malbim does. Right? We've talked about, I think, on other occasions, the doctrine of omnisignificance. The idea that everything in a pasuk must have some kind of meaning. And that's not a simple idea. And not everybody accepts that idea. Sometimes you'll see a commentary, including in the Gemara itself, say that the reason something is worded a certain way in the Chumash or in Navi is that it sounds good that way. It's poetic. The agents of omnisignificance say, no. Everything you see in a sentence has to have meaning. If first it said he asked for anashim ye'efim, or ayefim as it was there, and then it says that they refused to give the tzava, the army, that must mean something. If at first it says that he asked from this group responded, and then this group was punished, that has to have a meaning. So that's very much Malbim's approach, because remember where Malbim lives. Right? We've talked about this before. Malbim lives in the period when Haskalah and then Reform are growing in their influence. And one of their key points is this whole text of Tanakh that you have is written by human beings. So he is going to come back and respond with every single word here and every single letter has meaning because it's not just some human document.
Well after the sermon. Yeah. Validate.
Right. I found a problem with it though.
Yeah.
Originally, he read.
We're good at that.
Back in Pasuk Zion, yeah. He said that he was going to.
Yeah.
Via
the
him.
Flesh with the desert sore eyes.
He didn't say your elders are going to.
He's not the one doing it. Right. All
right. I hear that. I hear it. It doesn't bother me so much, but I hear it. I think Malvin will answer. I am going to be the agent of it. I'm going to be the
organizer and supervisor.
Yeah, maybe he doesn't want to give it away because then they'll find some way to deal with it. You know, if he comes back, if he says to them, "I'm going to have your elders thrash you,"
the elders won't be there. But was he justified in punishing them? Like, was he? You know, was this something that he was able to do on his own? Like, God did not tell him to do this. Like, is this something he was?
Right. So this is part of a broader theme in Shoftim, which really began already in Yehoshua, which is the harsh measures of a population at war. You know, when in the very beginning of Yehoshua, Reuven, Gad, Menashe say, if anybody doesn't listen to you, Yehoshua, we're going to kill them. Right? That's your tip-off. This isn't going to be a quiet, nice, gentle book. People are going to war, people are going to get hurt, and it will, in certain cases, be what we would consider barbaric. Right? We talked about it with Adoni Bezek, right? And what did he cut off his thumbs? Thumbs and big toes, which Adoni Bezek, in turn, had done to other people. Right, and that was just like this was the act of humbling, and we're going to see it again when he gets to execute Zebach and Salmunah. They're not surviving this parak. This is harsh.
Well, they're the enemy. I mean, this is his own people. You know. So, anyways.
Yeah,
I understand he has to punish them, but
yeah,
torture.
Indeed. Well.
Maybe not Yeshua, maybe the beginning of Shoftim, but they talked about God wasn't going to be with them all the time, and then they had to figure out how they were going to conquer the land, how they were. So I put this as part of it, because God wasn't fighting for them, so they had to figure out how to fight for themselves. This is how.
I mean, God is fighting for them, and in, you know, we saw all the miracles that indicate that God is supporting him, you know, in the whole initiation of the war, and the victory of 300 over the camp, and how they ended up being confused and fighting against each other and within the camp.
But he leaves the details.
But the details are up to Gideon to figure out, yeah. And this is a detail, but it gets worse. Take a look, please, at Pasuk Yud Zayin. Remember that he told the people of Penuel, I'm going to knock down your tower. Well, right, your fortress. Ves Migdal Penuel Nasas, right, he smashed the fortress in Penuel. Vayaharog Esanshei Ha'ir, and he executed the population. Okay.
That's, yeah, like, this is excessive punishment.
So this is a problem.
You're going to kill all the people. Why waste the good fortress?
Why, yeah.
Keep the fortress. Why destroy it?
Right. So we already saw Ralbag last week. Ralbag said this was always part of the plan. He chose not to say it to them in the beginning. And maybe that's along the lines of not telling them, I'm actually not going to be the one to carry this out. You know, someone else is going to do it for me. He didn't tell them in the beginning that he was going to do it. But this was always part of the plan, according to Ralbag. However, Radak, Barbanel, Masudat, David give a different explanation, which answers your question as well, Laura. If you take a look at number 4. Ve'ata haragis anshei ha'ir. Now he killed the population of the city. Maybe they fought against him when he came to destroy the fortress, right? Meaning they're not just going to let him do it, right? This is why you have a fortress. So, you know, he comes in, he says, look over here, Zevach and Salmuna, now excuse me while I batter down this wall, and they say, you got to be kidding me, and they fight him from the fortress, and he takes the fortress and kills the population.
What is the population was casualty?
Yeah, casualties of the battle.
He still just have like these 300 men.
Like, apparently, they're pretty well trained by now.
But they're very hungry.
They're also very well. They may not be hungry anymore. Maybe they got food in Penuel. In Sukkot, they got food in Sukkot.
Like, do one thing to Sukkot. Like, why didn't he just beat these people with thorns?
Right.
He never said they were hungry. He just said they were tired.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's more exhausted. And, but I, right, so we discussed last time the question of why give a different punishment to one versus the other, and our answer was, at the time, that, well, we gave a few different answers. One answer that we gave was Ralbag's answer. Ralbag said, whereas in Sukkot, it was the leadership that responded, in Penuel, it says the people. So the people as a whole responded, therefore they deserved this. The other answer was that in Sukkot, they legitimately fear the enemy, whereas in Penuel, they have a fortress. They don't have to have that fear of getting attacked. And therefore, it was inappropriate for them to, although apparently it's a vulnerable fortress.
And it wasn't such something that they could rely on.
And we don't know how long it took them. We don't know anything about this, you know, in that sense.
Wasn't impenetrable.
Yeah, I guess that's true, yes. So he then, you know, he executes or he kills in the war, however you want to look at it, the population of this city as well. I, you know, go all the way back to the beginning of our study of Shoftim. The Shoftim are not necessarily people you want to hang around with. They're difficult figures.
But it's a war.
Yes.
On the other side.
But it's bad your people.
You know, but bad things happen in wars.
Well, it brings up the worst in people, yeah. Obviously.
Yeah.
But it's your own people.
I mean, saying bad things happen in war can be a justification for an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be very careful about that as your you know, as your justification.
Well, if the purpose is to like to win the war, then you do whatever you have to do to win the war.
I should note
in general, the phrase he killed them, saying he killed the Anshei Ha'ir doesn't give us details on how many he killed or, you know, what exactly was going on. Right. We have no indication. It could really just be the people who fought him from the tower. It could be a certain number of people. We just don't know. It's not, the information's not there.
And he just gives these answers when they ask him for or whatever, but what provoked the seriousness? Like, just because it's war, and maybe they shouldn't have behaved that way. You know what I mean?
Well, keep in mind, like, if you want to go further with it, keep in mind that he is the commander-in-chief, and this is wartime. And if you have a precedent of not supporting and not obeying the orders, you have a very serious problem.
So he has to prove something so the next time.
Yeah, maybe that's part of it. Yeah. I mean, we're going to come back to this because there's more to say about Sukkot and Penuel. We're not done with that. But I want to first show you what happens with Zevach and Salmuna so we can wrap up all the blood at once. because they're, remember what you said initially about the these various tribes, they have multiple populations, multiple clans, and each one has its own leader. So like when you defeat the Amaleki in a certain area, or you defeat the Amori in one area, that doesn't mean you destroyed all the Amaleki and all the Amori and so on. There are other populations that are living in different spaces. Right. I mentioned it regarding Amalek, although we haven't seen it inside, but the story in Shmuel, where on the one hand we're told that Shaul wipes out all of Amalek except for the king, Agag, but just several prakim later we find Amalek raids and burns the Jewish city of Ziklag. Right? In just a few chapters. I mean, that's to explain Purim. That's to explain how it is you have a descendant of Agag. Mm-hmm. Haman is called the Agagi, so that's the answer that's given. But there, it's not like there are years that pass in between. We know because in one, it's Shaul's last year before David is going to be coronated, and the next story happens while David is a fugitive from Shaul. It's not like there have been years and years to develop a new Amalek. And Agag couldn't have rallied people around him and started again with a new group because Agag is dead. Right? Shmuel killed him. The answer has to be that there were multiple populations and that's why you have Zerach and Zalmunna. Okay. Unless there's some other mysterious answer for how it's like happened, but I can't figure what it would be. Okay. The problem with that is not that. The problem with it is when you have all these I don't know if they're midrashim, but just people say the reason Purim happens is because he left Agag alive. Mm-hmm. Amalek was going to be around anyway, because you had these other Amalek populations. So maybe the answer is yes, but the descendant of Agag, Haman as descendant of Agag, wouldn't have been around. Okay. Mm-hmm. Fine. We go further here with Zerach and Zalmunna. Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. This is now new. We didn't read this at all last time, so... let's
just what we read last week.
Well, we had read the psukim ahead last week. We didn't actually explain them. So now we'll read 18 to 21. Yerchet Chaf Aleph. Vayomer el Zevach ve'el Tzalmunna. So now, Zevach and Tzalmunna, who presumably were rooting, they were rooting for Sukkot and Pnuel, during this period of time. He turns to the two of them and he says, Efo ha'anashim asher haragtem b'savor. Where are the people you killed on Har Tavor? He says to them, Har Tavor, go figure. We don't know anything about people he killed. They killed on Har Tavor. So Vayomru, and they said to him, Kamocha kimohem echad kisoar b'nei hamelech. Like you, like them, are one. Meaning, they look just like you. They look like princes. Is that flattery? Is that,
He's not even answering the question. He's asking where they are and...
The whole discussion here in Pasuk Yudchet in sentence 18 is very difficult. Vayomar, and he says back to them, Achai b'nei imihem. He says, yeah, you're right, they look like me. They were my brothers, sons of my mother. Chai Hashem, by God, he swears, Lu hachiyisem osam, lo haragti eschem. Had you kept them alive, I wouldn't be about to kill you, he says. And then actually, one of the commentators on this, I forget whether it's Malbim or Ralbag, one of the two, I think, says that the practice in those days would have been to keep their king alive, not to kill the king, which raises other questions about Shaul and Agag. But the practice would have been to keep them alive, but now he's going to kill them because they killed his brethren, who we don't know about, we don't know what they're talking about yet. But that's what he says to them. But now watch what happens at Pasuk Chaf. Vayomer liyeser b'choro. He says to his firstborn son, Yeser, Kum haro gosam. Get up and kill them. He's good at delegating. Velo shalaf hana'ar charbo ki yarei. The kid doesn't pull his sword because he's scared. Ki yodenu nar, because he's a kid. Vayomer Zevach v'tzalmunna. So Zevach and Tzalmunna say, Kum ata ufga banu. You get up and hit us. Ki cha'ish gevuraso. Like a man, his strength. Meaning, not just be a man, but we'd rather be killed by somebody with some strength as opposed to being killed by this kid.
That's embarrassing.
Maybe because it's embarrassing, we'll see. But they're worried about their honor.
Right.
In the same way that Sisera falling to a woman, the whole business with Devorah's initial prediction.
Right.
Vayakam Gidon. Gidon got up. Vayarog Yizebach Samunah. He says, okay. He killed the two of them. I don't know why they thought that was
challenge accepted.
Vayikach es hasaharonim asher b'tzavrei gimaleihem. And he took the saharonim from the necks of their camels. Sahara, I think, desert, right, is a term for the moon. Sihara in Aramaic. The saharonim are half moon ornaments that hang on the neck of the camel. To which you have to ask, who cares? Why are you telling me that? This whole
also, but is why that all like, about the kid that he didn't end up doing anything?
Isn't there some kind of like something that you can then show to say I now have their half moons? You know, like
maybe.
Only, it was like their special thing that no one would touch. It
right.
Belonged to the kings, but now I have it, and that's my proof to anyone else that they're dead, and that I killed them.
Maybe. The whole thing is very strange. Who are the people who they killed on Har Tabor? Right? What does their response mean? Right? He killed Jews in Penuel, right? But now he doesn't want to be the one to kill Zebach and Salmuna. He got his hand dirty before. The whole thing is weird. And is it a good idea to have your young son be the one to execute the captive, kings? Yeah, the whole thing is strange. We have no idea. He's a Nar, but like I said, Nar can mean anything. Nar is not a...
Why
is
you
not.
Him? Wouldn't you leave your kids at home when you're fighting a war?
Maybe. Maybe not.
He's in training.
He has a sword.
Training for what? He wasn't expecting to be in this leadership role. He was just a guy sitting at home.
It's funny because we talk initially about Gideon's father. And
yeah.
Like we have... You almost think of him as young, but then all of a sudden he has a son.
Right, well, he was old enough that he was taking care of the grain, right? He was doing the threshing of the grain. So, he has
to. But we never heard that he had a family before.
Correct.
And now all of a sudden he has a son.
Right.
And maybe more. Right.
Right.
And he has brothers.
Well, brothers or brother?
So.
Is that.
Sorry?
When he says brothers. Does it really mean his brothers, or it means
no,
brethren?
Right, so that's what we have to know. Like, who are these people? What are you, what is this whole thing about? So, so what exactly is this? I'll give you two approaches. One approach is Da'at Mikra. Da'at Mikra, we've already mentioned this before, asked the question way back when. We had read in the beginning of this war that Gideon sent messages to the northern tribes, wanting them to help. But we don't find them showing up. So maybe they're part of the group that comes down at the end to do battle, but it's very unclear. So Da'at Mikra believes that that's what happened. Zebach and Salmuna's forces headed off the allies coming from the north and killed them on Har Tabor. That's what happened to the people in the north, and those are the ones who were killed, which is why the survivors get in late. So we already said that before, that they didn't make it. This is what he's pinning it on. This is what the Da'at Mikra view, I think it's Dr. Elitzur, pins it on, is the fact that here he's talking about, they're talking about having killed people in the north. The other approach is Malbim's approach, and Malbim says no. These, and in that case, by the way, they're not his brothers. They're his cousins. But think about what the significance of that is. We're worried about splits. We're worried about people not viewing themselves as part of the nation with others and not viewing the other tribes as their brethren. Gideon is the good guy. He says, that's my family. Those are brothers, son of my mother, which is an expression of closeness.
He's uniting the people.
Yeah.
Even though they didn't all come to war and they didn't all this and some.
Right.
And
so,
some fought and some didn't.
And now he's going to avenge their death. Mm-hmm. That's his point. He said, I wouldn't have killed you, but
leadership and bringing them in.
And it's what we want the nation as a whole to learn. So he takes it personally. Malbim just thinks that they actually killed Gideon's actual relatives. That Gideon's relatives were involved in the pursuit of the Midianites who were fleeing, and that Zebach and Salmuna killed them. And Gideon says, well, now I have to avenge them. So he says, now I have to kill you. And there's a lot here in Malbim. Malbim has this whole additional read to what's going on here, but I'm not going into it. But he wants Yeter to be the one to do it. So, Malbim suggests maybe it's the Goel Hadam concept, because Malbim believes they actually are relatives of his. The Goel Hadam is the relative of the person who was killed, and his job is to go after the murderer. So that's a simple read. But Abarbanel says something different, which is going to have to be relevant in the next parak. But take a look at source number 5 on your sheet. He says, Kedesha hanar yadchil gvuraso barigas shnei malachim. He says, this way the kid will begin to display his strength by killing two kings. Shu kavod gadol v'siman tov lasid. Right? It's an honor, it's a sign of what he's going to be like in the future. Everyone's going to know, don't mess with this kid. He's the one who killed the two kings. He's establishing him. Since Zebach and Salmunah have to be killed anyway, as the kings of the enemy and as the people who murdered, whether it was the Jews coming from the north or whether it was Gideon's relatives, and he's going to use it as an opportunity to establish his son. And the reason I say it's going to be very important is because we're going to hit here the issue of succession and who is going to lead the Jews after Gideon. So what Abarbanel is suggesting is that Gideon wants his son to take over for him. And that again is what we're gonna see going forward. Okay. However, the kid doesn't want to do it. He's not interested. They want Gideon to be the one to do it. So Abarbanel says it's an honor thing. They don't want to be killed by a kid. However, the other way to look at it is Radak in source number 6. Won't be as painful. Lo namus ayde na'ar shenitztaer b'pgiaso ki ein lo gevura v'kawach. Right, the Bekoach Adin, or Adayin, it might be yet. It's only written with one yod there, but it might be Adayin. She'akeb banu b'pamachas mehera. We don't want to die via a kid, such that we'll be in pain when he hits us, because he lacks strength, such that he would be able to strike us once and have it be over with. So they don't want it. They want it to be him, and he does. Sorry?
Experienced warrior.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, he's having mercy on them.
Well, no, but his kid backed out.
No.
The kid doesn't want to do it. Like, what's he going to do? Have a scene with his kid? Kill him? No, I'm not killing them. Kill him. We've all been in this situation, you know. It's better to use the situation, just kill them yourself.
The kings are begging for.
And he doesn't want the reputation of his kid to get any worse.
Right. That's maybe also.
That's the story.
He couldn't even kill the king.
He couldn't even kill the kings.
Right.
Made him try.
I just want to be a pacifist, Dad.
Like target practice first.
Yeah. So, in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, he does it, and then he takes these half moon ornaments. So, the Abarbanel says this is actually an element of praise to Gideon. I'm just looking at what I brought there. No, I brought a different Abarbanel. Oh well, the Abarbanel that I brought there is the one who talks about it as a matter of honor. In the previous point, which is also good, but the Abarbanel I wanted to bring was he says this is the point here is that that's all Gideon took. In other words, as the leader, he had the right to take all the spoils, but he said, "I just want the ornaments that are on the necks of these two kings' camels. That's all I'm looking for."
Well, what other spoils would they have with them?
I mean, any of their weapons, their armor, their whatever.
Well, they were captured, presumably, kind of in the middle of the night, in their tent, weren't they?
Yeah, but you have all their stuff. I mean, the spoils doesn't mean literally what's physically on them. It's everything from their camp.
They captured them. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the way Abarbanel reads it. Radak has a different take. Radak says we're going to find out in the rest of this parak what he does with a whole bunch of gold that comes from their camp, and this is the start of Gideon collecting a whole bunch of gold as we're going to see. But before we see that, I actually want to spend a little bit more time on Sukkot and Penuel. Those who were here last time or who heard the recording, what are the cities of Sukkot and Penuel to the Jews long before this ever happened? Where the first appearance of Sukkot and Penuel? It was on the fuzzy part of the recording.
I was alive.
When they left Mitzrayim.
In the desert.
And before that.
Yaakov?
Before they left Mitzrayim. They camped in Sukkot, but we said that was a different Sukkot.
Oh, yeah, different Sukkot.
That's one is their first stop out of Egypt. Yaakov, right. The Yaakov at the Yarden.
Yeah.
When Yaakov is coming back with his family, right? So after the incident with the Malach, he's at Penuel, and then he meets Esav, and you know, they make some kind of peace between them. Esav seems happy with him. Esav says, I'd like to travel with you. And he says, thanks, but no thanks. And then afterwards, they camp at Sukkot. So Penuel and Sukkot are the cities that bracket Yaakov's encounter with Esav. Right? It's Penuel first, and then Sukkot. So, okay, fine. What does it have to do with anything? Think about what these people now, the modern Sukkot and Penuel, what their language and action to Gideon represents.
Esav.
It's not that they're being Esav, I think, as much as that they're siding with Esav. Right? They're saying, look, we have to get along with Midian. So we don't want to help you and expose ourselves to harm from Midian. What that means, effectively, is they're not worried about harm from Gideon, right? The situation of other Jews is less significant to them, and they've chosen their neighbors as Midian, which is a theme, again, that we've talked about a lot, as opposed to Gideon, yeah?
But it's not surprising, because they've been under the rule of Midian. So right as a yardstick,
right.
They realize, like, who's in power.
But Gideon doesn't do it. Right? Gideon... number one, go back to last week. We said that Gideon pursues Midian east, even east of the Yarden, right? That's where he's going when this happens. Why does Gideon need to do anything with Midian east of the Yarden? That's not where he lives. That's not where his tribe is.
Well, because he didn't want them to go towards the other people who are in the east.
That was what we said, right?
Right.
We said exactly. He's trying to safeguard...
But he has his unity. He doesn't want the rest of the people to be...
He's looking out for everybody. In his view... The Jew looks out for all of the Shvatim, and not only for himself and his family, and certainly not for Midian. And so he is specifically, you know, geared towards the unity of the nation and all of the Shvatim. When they talked about killing the people on Tavor, right, he called them his brothers, even though, as we said, it's not so clear that they're anybody related to him. It doesn't matter. He views them all as his brethren. More to that, Penuel and Sukkot, are the ones who said, right, are the places where Yaakov said, I'm not going to travel with Esav. Right? Esav said, why don't you come with me? And he said, well, catch up at Seir eventually. These are the places where he said, I'm going to go my way and not stay with Esav. But the people of these cities failed to learn the lesson. It's also striking to realize at Penuel, that's where he's limping, right? That's where Yaakov is limping, at Penuel. The sun shines for him, and he is limping. Why is he limping? Because he got hit by the Malach. Why was the Malach able to attack him? Or whatever this being is, call it what you like. Why was this being able to attack him?
Was he lying down at the time?
No. Because he was alone. Vayivaser Yaakov levado. And you may recall Rashbam comments, I think we mentioned at some point, that the reason why the Jews don't eat Gid Hanasha, you know, we associate it with the fact that this wound. But Rashbam says it's a reminder that we blew it by leaving him alone. There's no reason for Yaakov to be alone. Yaakov has all these, you know, how old is Reuven at this point? He's definitely at least a teenager.
Mm-hmm. It's their fault. He crossed them over, came back. He's the father. He's the head of the household.
They're old enough that they should be going with him.
I know.
They shouldn't be leaving him alone.
They're going for him.
Yaakov is 80-something years old, or even older, actually, at that point. There's no reason for him to be... Actually, we know how old he is, right? Because he's 137 when he meets Paro. And Yosef at that point is 39. So that means that Yosef is born when he's 98. And Yosef was already born before this. Right? And then they went through all the things with the Sally. Yaakov is like 100 years old here. Now, granted that, you know, 101 used to be. But even still, there's no reason for his kids to be leaving him to take things themselves. And that's what Rashbam says. They're punished for not looking out for each other. That's the key. And that points us also to what I had mentioned before about this lack of giving the food and so forth being like what Ammon and Moab and those others did. It's this ultimate division that they've generated. So that's what I think is sort of a deeper layer here in telling us the story of Sukkot and Penuel. It's the Jews haven't yet learned the lesson of their past. Gideon is trying to exemplify it to them, but they still aren't at that stage. Clear? That's the idea. So that was the second decline, right? The first decline was Ephraim and their ingratitude to Gideon. The second decline is this is the decline into separatism, I guess, is the best word for it. It's the division that takes place. And then we get the third decline, and easily the most shocking. Meaning you could have predicted that there would be strife and issues like that. Take a look at what happens here in the rest of the parak. Pasuk Chav Bet, sentence 22. Vayomru ish Yisrael el Gid'on. The Jews, ish Yisrael, don't take as one person. It means the people. Say to Gideon, Mishol banu gam ata, gam bincha, gam ben benecha. Rule over us. You, your son, and your son's son. We want your descendants to lead us. Ki hoshatanu miyad Midian, because you saved us from Midian. Vayomar alehem Gideon. Gideon says to them, Lo emshol ani bachem. I am not going to rule over you. Velo yimshol bini bachem. My son will not rule over you. Hashem yimshol bachem. God is going to rule over you. Which sounds like he's refusing the throne. Right? That's what it sounds like. Okay. Vayomar alehem Gideon. But Gideon says to them, Esh alami kem she'ela. I do have a request. Remember, she'ela in biblical Hebrew tends not to mean question. It means a request. So, here's my request from you. Utnu li ish nezem shalalo. Each of you, I want you to give me a nezem from the spoils. What's a nezem?
A nose ring.
A nose ring. Right? Give me a nose ring. I like nose rings. Because as Yishma'elim, they had nose rings.
How were they Yishma'elim?
Yeah, wait, what? Yishmael, they're Midian, aren't they? Not to mention, it's very funny to see this little note about, you know, Ishmaelite fashion. Like, they had nose rings because they're Ishmaelites, don't you know?
Earrings. It doesn't say nose rings, it says earrings.
That's interesting.
That's what it says.
Okay. Well, I will remain with my question. Whether it's a nose ring or an earring doesn't particularly bother me. But I will say that that it's a ring of some kind. That's what I would stipulate. Okay. So, we find the word nezem as an earring at the Egel. Right? When it says they took the gold from the ring, it says, Nizmei hazahav asher be'oz nehem. So there were earrings that were nezem, but we also find nezem as a potential nose ring. I wouldn't get hung up on that, although Abarbanel will. We won't see it this week, we'll see it next week. Abarbanel actually is going to stress the nose ring aspect of it. But the Ishmaelim evidently wear rings of some kind, and Gideon wants each person to give him one. Whether they're earrings or nose rings, I'm not sure he needs that many. So, Vayomru, and they said, Nason Nitain. You bet, we'll give it. Vayifrasu es hasimla, they spread out this big cloth. That's a play on a pasuk in Chumash, the being praised the simla, in a very different context. Vayifrasu es hasimla, vayashlichu shama ish nezim shalalo. They spread out this garment, and they each throw in a ring. Right? You imagine the line of soldiers, and they each, you know, toss in a ring. Vayhi mishkal nizmei hazahav asher sha'al elef ushvameyos zahav. There is an awful lot of gold there.
Is this just the 300 men?
Not sure. Don't know. It's a good question.
Assuming it's his army. It's only the people of his army, not all of the Jews of Israel.
But again, not all the Jews of Israel. Maybe also it includes those people who came down from the mountain to fight.
But they tell them that they took out their nose ring and their earrings.
No, but 300 men could kill like a 100,000.
I mean, I don't know that people went to war with these rings in. I don't know what the story was, but
yes, so they went through the weight of the amount of earrings.
No.
But what is your question?
You have one. You have an earring. My interpretation is earring from each man.
each of the people that they killed.
No, it's the warriors. It's a ring from each of the Jews.
The warriors? No.
The warriors took the rings from the spoils.
Right.
So what he's saying is, each warrior, I want you to go to your spoils, go to whatever you took, and take out one ring and give it to me.
Okay.
They could have taken a whole.
They could have as many as they have.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
That's not how many people they killed.
Okay.
He doesn't say where his four.
Yeah, he will.
And wait.
Lead over us. I won't, but give me a nose ring.
Right. Yes. Isn't it strange, no? Elef ushvameo zahav, so it's 1,700 units of gold. We don't know what a unit is. Levad mina saharonim, aside from the saharonim, don't forget those, vehanatifos, as well as the natifot. So natifot have different explanations. Rashi quotes you from the Aramaic on this, that it's crowns. Others say it's some kind of a gold bowl that was used to hold spices, like nataf in the Kitaras. The Dad Mikra says that it's gold, silver, or gems that they used to hang as charms from rings and necklaces. Also, and that's, I think, hanging probably from notate.
Pendants.
The pendants of some kind, yeah. That's what they say there?
The pendants.
Okay. Ubigdei ha'argaman, as well as they had argaman, purple wool, that they got off of it. The Shalmalchei Midyan, which came from the kings. Ulevad min ha'anakot asher b'tzavreg malehem, as well as the necklaces that they had from the necks of the camels. The camels wore necklaces. So they have all of this stuff. But Gidon just wants, you know, the ring. Vayas oso Gidon le'efod. And Gidon makes it into an ephod. What's an ephod?
Coat.
It's a tunic or a coat, yeah. A coat of some kind. Vayatzeg
os. That's a heavy coat.
It's a gold. What? Yeah, it's one of the clothing, one of the garments of the Kohen.
Yeah, the vestments of the high priest.
Yeah. Vayatzeg oso be'iro be'ofra. But no one's wearing this. He puts it on display in his city, Ofra. Vayiznu chol Yisrael acharav sham. And the Jews strayed after it there. What does straying after always mean? Right, but what kind?
Idolatry.
That's what it sounds like, isn't it? Vayihili Gidon ulaveso lemokesh. And it was a stumbling block for Gidon and for his household. Last pasuk, vayikana Midyan lefnei bnei Yisrael. Midyan was humbled before the Jews. Velo yasfula seis rosham, and they did not raise their head again. Vatishkod haaretz abayim shana bimei Gidon, and the land was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gidon. Some debate as to whether that includes the 7 years or doesn't include the 7 years, but clearly we have a lot of problems here.
Wow.
You don't stop being bothered about his son and Zevach and Salmunah, because we have other issues that we have to figure out here. What in the world happened here?
Where did he get that idea?
Not to mention, why did Gidon refuse the leadership role? Is that not what he's suited for at this point?
Then he takes the leadership role.
Yeah, he makes this big gold jacket.
I'm just saying, more like, it's not just me, it's God. You know, I'm leading, but I'm...
So maybe he's not refusing at all.
He's not refusing, but he's attributing his success to a higher authority.
Right, and that could be.
And the land was quiet for 4 years. So. Yeah, he still doesn't give him a reason. He says, I won't be your leader, or whatever. Give me your gold. But he doesn't tell them why, and they're like, okay, sure.
Right. But when you just killed Zevach and Salmunah, not to mention all the people in Sukkot and Penuel, the last thing people are going to ask is why. When Gidon asks you for something.
They are the ones who did it.
Yeah.
They are the army.
All right.
And they're rallying behind him because he's good to them.
So then how come there were 40 years of peace?
Good question. If this is really happening, if they descend into some kind of idolatry, then why is it quiet?
Well, it's quiet with Midian. They're not.
No, but why does God not cause another enemy to come upon them? Why do they get 40 years of quiet if in fact they're idolatrous?
Unless
so,
it's not idolatry.
Or unless there's another explanation. But we need to see. So come back next week.